bring a lot of attention to it. And in his spare time, he is a Methodist, but he's also can tell you the best pubs to visit if you come to Cornwall. So I hope you'll welcome him again and share in the wonderful things he has to tell us.
In recent decades, my view of festival has been an important way of articulating Cornish identity as a Cornish. More recent years, you've seen the emergence of the Daphne du Maurier Festival at Foy, which has been away, obviously, from a bit of the importance of the literature of Daphne du Maurier. And 3 years ago, the Scholar Festival, which I'm going to talk about this evening, was also established to provide a way for people to gain a greater understanding of the distinctive culture of the Mid-Cornwall region. And I'll say a little bit about that later on. Our third anniversary this year, we've decided to do something different. Instead of what we've traditionally done in the past couple of years, of having a weekend event, we've decided to extend it. So it started on the 21st of May with a medieval evening, talking about the culture of mid-Cornwall during medieval and Tudor times, i.e. before what existed in the area before China clay was discovered, and obviously continued straight through to the 27th of June. I'll say that. Exactly some of the things that we've been doing. But of course, this week, I'm delighted to actually come here to you and actually talk about the Scholar Festival, therefore making it very much a global expression of Cornish identity. But before getting on to the festival, I thought it'd be useful to talk a little bit about the clay culture, the distinctive nature of it. I say distinctive nature because the clay country is still very much a fairly part of Cornwall as a whole. But there are interesting subtle differences. So I thought we'd look first of all at the industrial side. What is it? Kaolin, essentially, is what has been worked in the mid-Cornwall area since it was first discovered back in 1746. William Cookworthy, who was in fact a Quaker from Devon, actually went down, more down to West Cornwall, down to Elston initially, and discovered clay deposits. It was referred to as Moorstone. Clay, as very nature might suggest, is an important thing when it comes to porcelain, essential obviously, and when Cookworthy came down to Cornwall in the 1740s and discovered what the locals referred to as Moorstone, it was essentially in order to develop his own porcelain industry. Fairly quickly, the industry decided to take off. But it was not until about a decade or so afterwards that more deposits were found in Mid-Cornwall, in particular in the parish of St. Stephen's, which very rapidly became the centre of production for China clay. Now, the industry for many years, and I've only got a small number of actual photographs just to pass along, so just pass one from table to table. But this will explain exactly what the industrial process is of China clay. And certainly up until maybe, say, the 1960s, it hadn't really developed in terms of the nature of what it was all about. More recently, it's become a very mechanized, technologically based industry. And then, as a result, much fewer workers. But it was very labor intensive from the 18th century onwards. And the process is very interesting. Put down those three photographs, you'll see them in a minute. Working the clay, settling the clay, and drying the clay. And just explain what that process is all about. Essentially, the clay would be broken up by blasting. Okay? So the land would be blasted. Then you would use water, more recently what is referred to as monitors, to actually break that clay up. And as it starts to break up, it starts to travel, naturally, in many cases, through streams. And depending on how pure the quality of the clay it is, it obviously flows more purely. That clay would then gradually move to what would be called settling plant. So there's a picture there of what is referred to as settling clay. at a little village called Bugle in Cornwall, which is very close to where I live now. It's a village that I went to school in. We still go to Methodist Church there as well. And the clay would settle, and you'd see some buildings there in the back, which would become the bottom part, but the dry in the clay. So the clay would be broken up, it would gradually flow along and would settle, and it would then be dried, and obviously then taken around, depending, initially obviously it would be taken by wagon, or by train. In fact, the wagons continued for many years. My great-grandfather was actually working on a farm, as well as carrying clay to ports like Charlestown and Foy and Parr in the 1920s and 1930s. It only then started to become more mechanized. So if I just pass that along, let's give you a bit of an insight into the actual industry side itself. Now, as you'll see on the handout, the industry developed in the early 19th century, in particular, as farmers started to diversify. I don't know if you have that expression in America, but farmers diversify, very important certainly back in Cornwall as well. But farmers, it's nothing new, in the early 1800s they already diversified. They would find this moorstone on their own land, so they would go from being farmers to actually becoming industrialists. And a good example, and if some of you may have, I don't know if anybody's been to the China Clay Museum outside St. Austell. It's called Real Martin, or China Clay Country Park now. Well worth a visit, actually. China Clay family, the Martins, were farmers originally, but they started to actually work the clay that they found on their own land. They too decided to diversify, and in fact, the family went from the clay industry to car manufacturing. So I don't know if anybody's come across the Aston Martin company. It's the same family. They altered the Y to an I, but it is the same family. And they were typical, really, of the sort of like farming families moving over to clay. Now, when this was happening in the early 19th century, tin mining was still very prominent. Tin and copper mining was still very prominent throughout Cornwall. You'd have tin and copper mining in mid-Cornwall as well. But with the collapse of mining, particularly in the 1860s, clay started to come into its own. And that's the interesting thing. We heard from Gage this morning about the narrative of depression in America, but El Grass Valley itself was prosperous, progressing during the 1930s. And this is where mid-Cornwall starts to stand out from the rest of Cornwall. Because as mining collapsed, many of the money that was actually invested in mining companies started to actually be invested in China clay. In fact, for a while in the 1870s, you started to see tin mining and China clay companies operating together. In fact, up to 1914, you actually still find some tin streaming and China clay works operating together. But essentially, as this money started to flow in with the collapse of mining, the clay industry became the mainstay of that mid-Cornwall area. Now, socially and culturally, working in clay wasn't necessarily seen as a good thing. Many miners would actually look down their noses at clay workers as almost being beneath them. But the reality was, it actually brought relative prosperity. By the late 19th century, when mining had essentially collapsed in Cornwall, clay was actually very much coming into its own. And in fact, if you look at the architecture of that St. Austell area, and again, interesting going back to what was mentioned earlier about chapels appearing in Grass Valley, I think work was being done in the 1930s, which was mentioned. Similarly, a lot of the chapels which were actually built or extended in the early 20th century was actually quite late. But it simply reflected the fact that that money in the first decade of the 20th century was there through clay. And a lot of the villages, some of them have very old Cornish names, like Penwithick. Penwithick, where I live, which dates back to the 1200s, the actual architecture today is very much early 20th century. A lot of pressure, however, started to build up, because although money started to find its way into the building of Methodist chapels, there was growing concern by many of the cane workers that they themselves were not actually benefiting from this. And you see in 1913 the so-called China Clay Country Strike, which became a very bitter strike. Cornwall doesn't have very much of a strike tradition, actually. There was industrial unrest suddenly in the 1870s amongst miners and to some extent amongst clay workers as well. But 1913 saw a very bitter strike. The local police force was unable to actually control the strikers who demanded greater pay and recognition of their trade union. But the local police were unable to control it, so much so that police had to come from South Wales and Bristol to actually come down to Cornwall. We were regarded very much as an army of occupation at the time, to actually control these Cornish rebels. And in fact, in 1914, just a year after, of course, Britain entered the First World War, and many clay workers refused to fight for this thing because they argued that the government did not help us during a time of peace. Now they expect us to actually fight. That was the argument. But things were starting to happen within the clay industry, very much so, because the nature of the market for clay was also changing. Because in the early days, like I said, porcelain was the principal market. But increasingly, there were other sources that it could be put towards. Paper. In more recent decades, magazines, more glossy magazines, actually used material from China clay. Cosmetics as well, female cosmetics, also of certain men of clay traditionally. So as these new opportunities expanded, and so there was much more demand for clay, and also the export market started to take off. By the time of the First World War, 75% of the output of clay was not going to a UK market, but was going overseas. And that essentially very much shaped an industry which, by the early 1920s, realised that it actually had to rationalise, it had to become a much more effective professional business. Because the clay country essentially had only about 70, though it was only a small area, had 70 individual producers. Many of them were the same farmers who had actually worked in the industry before. But by the time of the interwar period, the industry very much started to actually rationalise, and essentially you ended up with what still exists today, two companies. The larger English Shiny Clays, Lovering and Poaching Company, which has now become Imerys, which is a French company, but in turn it's actually owned by a French-Canadian company, and it's become very much a multinational concern. And a much smaller Goonveen and Rossaret company, which is owned by Lord Falmouth, one of Cornwall's peers, the Falmouth Estates. But as the industry developed during the 1920s and 1930s, we also start to see some other interesting things. Because it was an export industry, it was very much affected by export markets. So in the early 1920s, the industry, after the First World War, after the upheaval that was caused by the war, started to go into recession. Common practice was said to be tramping the clay country because the workers were unable to actually get work. But by the late 1920s, there was a dramatic change and the industry was able to expand much more quickly. By the early 1930s, of course, reflecting the depression, there was again a collapse in markets for clay. But it fairly quickly recovered so that by 1935, the situation was much more healthier in mid-Cornwall. We're talking of relative prosperity here because the situation as a result of depression was briefly 32% of the workforce in Cornwall were unemployed, particularly obviously in the mining areas, and that was to continue straight through to the late 30s, so an interesting parallel is what we heard this morning. Even then 20% of Cornwall's workforce throughout Cornwall were unemployed, but in mid-Cornwall the industry was actually very relatively prosperous. And that continued after the Second World War, when Cornwall became the centre of what was regarded as a global monopoly. The ECLP, China Clay Company, was able to buy up a lot of clay works throughout Europe, Celtics fan in Brazil. But what the workforce and the employers, who were working much more closely together by this time, could take pride in, was that this company, despite the fact that throughout Cornwall still, by the 50s and 60s, was relatively high unemployment, in mid-Cornwall it was relatively prosperous. And the fact to have a global monopoly, as they regarded it, based in St. Austell, was very important, something which was unheard of throughout the rest of Cornwall. And that has been the situation up until more recent decades. By the 1960s, there were signs that China clay companies were losing out, and the deposits that were being found in Cornwall, again reflecting changing markets, were not so easy to actually obtain. There was very good pure quality clay which existed, which could only be found in Cornwall, but at the same time other markets, other clay deposits throughout the world were actually much more accessible. It wasn't to some extent a big deal because the clay company was actually based in Cornwall. But the problem happened in the 1990s when the China clay industry was bought by a New Zealand company, and then obviously more recent years being owned by Imerys, a French-based company, because Cornwall could no longer rely on the security of having a global monopoly based in Cornwall. And that situation has started to become increasingly acute. Despite that fact, however, 1,000 people are still employed in Cornwall working in the clay industry. If you compare that to mining, that's obviously something to be proud of, really. And it's likely to continue, certainly for the next 20 or 30 years, that there will be some form of mining. The tin miners will not have liked it. It will be clay mining. That actually continues. But I'll say a little bit briefly about the cultural side that accompanies that, because mining, clay mining, because mid-Cornwall's economic development was much more different, that had a knock-on impact on what was happening elsewhere. So, for example, the principal sport of Cornwall is seen as rugby, very much like Wales, South Wales with rugby. But in the St. Austell area, it's actually football, reflecting the fact that the industry has actually developed differently and at different times. And there are other interesting subtle differences. Mid-Cornwall was very much, in the past, a Methodist stronghold. If you go back to 1851, 60% of those people who worshipped on a Sunday were Methodist. Another 10% were generally regarded as free church non-conformist, which left, in fact, less than 30% Anglican. But there were differences. Cornwall, as a whole, has tended to be regarded as a Wesleyan, some would actually pronounce it, Methodist denomination. But in mid-Cornwall, it tended to be more Bible Christian. Bible Christians dominated, along with other groups like the Primitive Methodists. So there were clear, subtle differences. Methodists, yes, but the denomination was distinctly different. And the reason for Bible Christian denomination was that in the neighbouring parish at Luxillian, William Bryant, founder of the Bible Christian denomination, that was where he was born. His farm, he actually had a Methodist chapel, Bible Christian chapel built on it. And that became the centre. And as the clay industry expanded in the late 19th century, the workforce primarily came from a lot of the agricultural parishes around about where Bible Christians were very dominant. So naturally, they moved into the clay industry, built their chapels. There's also differences in music. Music for heritage is very much an important part of Cornish heritage. And we think of music, we instantly think of Thomas Merritt. You do have Thomas Merritt carol choirs going on way into the 1960s and then the 1970s. In fact, Mascola, and I'll come back to Mascola a little bit later, had a very popular Thomas Merritt carol that was actually taught throughout Cornwall, and its performances were actually recorded on radio, etc. But there was a male voice choir tradition that was developing in the area, and the 1950s was actually the heyday of a popular local hymn-writing tradition. Didn't exist in other parts of Cornwall, partly because of the paralysis caused by collapse of mining, but a buoyant area like mid-Cornwall, which was sustained by prosperous industry, was able to find that expression through more other ways of actually expressing that religious place for music. So in 1955, a little clay village called Trevisco entered the International Welsh Eisteddfod at Llangollen. They went in against 20 choirs from all around the world, the former Yugoslavia, Russia, Germany, Italy. They were beaten by just 1 point by an Italian choir, which was sponsored by the Italian government, which included the late, great Luciano Pavarotti and his father. And they beat them by just 1 point. The following year, Trevisco went in and actually were outright champions. So the 1950s was interesting enough, a period when Mid Cornwall was very buoyant and prosperous, and it differs in that sense from other areas. I won't say too much about politics, but nonetheless, we should look at the political differences there. Mid Cornwall, in common with other parts of Cornwall to some extent, was very much part of the liberal tradition. In fact, if anything, Mid Cornwall was even more liberal. It was the strongest Liberal Party seat before the First World War. But the impact of the 1913 clay strike, strangely enough, encouraged the Labour Party. So whereas the Labour Party failed to actually make a breakthrough in other parts of Cornwall, Camborne was perhaps a bit of an exception. In the 1920s and 1930s, the Labour Party was gradually able to build on its base. Many people will come across A.O. Rouse, the historian. A.O. Rouse was also political candidate for the Labour Party and came close to victory in the 1930s, sustaining that tradition. But by the 1970s, a local populist Liberal candidate was able to revive the Liberal Party fortunes throughout Mid Cornwall and actually restore that Liberal tradition. But also, another interesting thing politically, I don't know if anybody has come across Mebion Curnow. Mebion Curnow is Cornwall's own political party, actually. There is a, I don't know how it would be regarded in the US. It's very similar to sort of like Plaid, I don't know if people have heard of Plaid Cymru and the Scottish National Party. Basically, it's sort of like a regionalist party. And Mid Cornwall is interesting enough, the main stronghold for Mebion Curnow, Sons of Cornwall, in Cornwall. In fact, in the European elections, they took 10% of the vote in the last election and actually outpolled Labour Party, the second party in the clay country after the Liberal Democrats, is actually Mebion Curnow. So there's some interesting things that's going on today in terms of politics. That's just a little bit of a background to what the actual culture and the industry is in Mid Cornwall, its similarities and its differences. So why Wyscola as a festival? Wyscola is only a small little village, but a few years ago the Methodist chapel, like so many in Cornwall, actually closed down. It was originally a primitive Methodist chapel. And a group of us, I was the chairman actually at that stage, decided that we should actually purchase this chapel and create a heritage centre based there, which at the same time would work closely with the University of Exeter, what I was talking about this morning, so that there would be a strong community centre and there would be a strong educational centre. And the area was very much rich in the sort of like oral traditions of the area. We haven't got time to actually talk about the extent of that, but it's a very colourful past associated with the area, and in particular the local Methodist chapel, which in fact set up its own rival chapel just down the road. There are only about 40 properties in the village, but there are the two Methodist chapels fighting out between themselves, the Wyscola Primitive Methodist Church and the Wyscola Tabernacle. That's part of that tradition. But at the same time, there was something which I will now pass around another photograph. Well, another two photographs, actually. Band of Oak. Brass bands are also part of that musical tradition, very closely associated with the Methodist Church. And in Cornwall, we have Sunday school anniversaries. Do you have anniversaries in the tradition? Basically, the anniversary of the actual church, or the anniversary of the Sunday school. And it's become an important procession, which you celebrate the commitment of religious ancestors in the past. So you it's not about processions, and I'll explain it this thing in a minute too. What's it called? Snail Creek. Down the bottom, you also have a picture of the Berliner Spiken Drum Band from the 1930s. Those top photographs are actually earlier, from early 1900s. Pass again. Snail Creek was very much associated in the past, particularly some of the eastern clay villages. Don't tend to find them in other parts of Cornwall, only in that part of mid-Cornwall. Snail Creek, we should really do a Snail Creek here, shouldn't we? Basically, you would have a row of couples which would actually go along arm in arm. Something similar to Elston Ferry, I don't know if anybody's seen this, but it's similar. And there would be a large number of people. In 1902, in the village, the past the photographs around, the village of Bugle, 1,000 people actually danced this. The procession would wind itself around, gradually, into the shape of a snail shell, and then would sort of like unwind, and the couples would go in radically different directions. So it would end up in total anarchy, really. Now, in 1881, W.C. Wade, who was an antiquarian, wrote about Snail Creek and referred to it as an ancient Cornish dance. Don't know how ancient it is, but suddenly we've got that written evidence of 1881. The interesting thing was it was actually kept alive by the Methodist Church. Whereas Methodism tended to have the reputation in Cornwall for actually frowning on dancing, drinking or anything. It was Methodism, surprisingly, which kept it alive, gave it a new lease of life as a dance, or they wouldn't refer to it as a dance, the Snail Creek Procession, which would be kept alive for Sunday school anniversaries. And it's the sort of thing that you would see there, really. It would be linked into many of the actual processions. So, it was very popular up until the 1930s. The outbreak of the Second World War would change things, because, like so many things, you know, obviously the impact of having to fighting a war meant that traditional customs tend to be put to one side. It was revived in 1946, but only carried on for two more years. It lost its momentum by that time. Anyway, 3 years ago, we decided to revive it. And here's a picture of it now. First of all, I'll show you a picture at the top of children, we've got local school children, actually performing a version of Snail Creek at the Eden Project in Midport, which is about a mile from where I live and about 2 miles from the school. Then we've got the bottom of the middle picture, Snail Creek procession actually in the scholar, and then the procession through the village. So by reviving this event, we came fairly closely to the traditional time when it was performed, which is always the last weekend of June at the scholar. But we've built around that a series of other educational events, a series of educational lectures, linking in some way to the clay country, clay country's history. The first year we had a literature symposium looking at the very rich literary tradition of mid-Cornwall area, whether that's Daphne du Maurier, whether that's A.O. Rouse, Clemo, the poet, the blind poet. And we tend to go for a different theme every year. Next year's theme, we're planning to actually have a reunion of the Wiscola family. Wiscola is obviously a name, a place name, but as so often the case in Cornwall, place names become the basis for family names. And so obviously with Wiscola, you just need to think about Rick Wiscola, who though originally coming from West Cornwall, his family ancestry came from the same village. In the Middle Ages, the Wiscola family were referred to as a yeoman family. Fairly well off, not really well off, but fairly well off farming family which owned a certain amount of land in that area. The family would to continue fairly affluent until the early 1800s. At that stage, their manor in Wiscola was in ruins, and the last member of the family significantly, appropriately, ended up working for the clay industry. So we've been in contact with people from British Columbia, other parts of the UK, who are quite keen to sort of like have a grand family reunion of this order. So next year's conference, next year's festival is going to have the theme of the clay country in Cornwall in the 1800s, period when the scholars came to an end as a locally established family. When obviously the Methodist Chapel was built in 1873, when obviously the clay industry started to expand, a very important century actually, and linked into that is going to be this Rescorla reunion. So if you come across any Rescorlas, put them in contact with me. Now, I was saying about the culture, and I'll just finish with looking at the distinctive nature of migration patterns from Mid Cornwall. As I said, the industry, the area was relatively prosperous because you still had an industry in place, whereas the economic foundations in West Cornwall totally collapsed with the collapse of mining. That wasn't the case in Mid Cornwall. That had interesting implications for migration, because they started to actually get a tendency. Early on, Mid Cornwall was no different than other parts of Cornwall. People started to actually move around overseas and such and work. But from the late 19th century, second half of the 19th century onwards, there was less need for that. You do have migration, and I'll show some examples in a minute, of where that actually did take place to California. But certainly, in this area, the tendency was for individuals to move overseas to places like the USA for shorter periods of time, maybe, say, for 10, 15 years. That way they could actually make enough money working overseas to actually come back to Cornwall. They could be virtually guaranteed of getting a job, but they had enough money to actually buy a house. And in fact, certainly in the late 19th century, the early 20th century, as I was saying, the architecture reflects that. Some of the actual buildings, some of the properties in that area, actually reflect American-style customs. You can actually see that in the actual architecture, because obviously this is where their ideas were coming from, working overseas for 2 years. And a good example, if we look at anecdotal evidence, is my own great-uncle, who died in the 1970s, in his late 90s, but who had spent about 18 years in the late 19th century, early part of the 20th century, getting money to actually then come back to Cornwall. And if you look at family migration, many families actually would migrate, many communities would actually migrate, perhaps to the same places. In my own family, again, give an anecdotal example, a few years ago I was tracing a family history. And I went down to a farm called Tregidga Farm on the Roseland, which is where my family came from originally in the 1300s. The name was first recorded in 1322, presumably a bit before then. But the story in my family had been that they'd lost the farm through drinking and gambling. And as a result, they became very Methodist. Many of them became Methodist preachers. That still carries on in my case, except I do drink as well as beer. But anyway, that was the story, that we lost the farm in the 1830s and 1840s. Now, we had no way of proving that we did manage, I say we, my father and myself, managed to do some census returns and analyse that census return and show that a member of our family, Charity Bassett, who had been married in 1793, farming family in Gowan, to William Tregidga, she was a pauper. So clearly something had happened in the family circumstances by the 1840s to Charity Bassett, who became a Tregidga. A few years ago, like I said, we were tracing the family history, and I went down to this farm, never been there before, took a photograph of the farm for the family album. With that, a camper van came along, and a lady got out of that camper van and started talking to her, and she had a London accent, and I said, "How come you take a picture of this sign?" Well, she said, "Because back in the 1840s, my family used to live there, and we lost that farm through drinking and gambling." So it's an interesting thing that story has actually been through two branches of the family. Yeah. Her family had actually moved to London. Donald Tregidga was the brother-in-law of Charity Bassett, who died as a pauper in the 1840s, and had moved to London and been kept alive for the family. But there's another twist to this, because interestingly enough, her ancestor, Donald Tregidga, actually left his family, sadly, in London, but moved to California and started a new family. And so the story goes on. And we've done a little bit of family history, and suddenly there was another Donald Trigidje, possibly a son, who was living in California in the 1890s. Interesting. So that brings me to final sort of like story to actually finish with. I put down here a few case studies. Like I said, many people would only briefly move from Midcornwall to actually go overseas. But there were some other interesting examples. These case studies actually come, as you see, at the top. They are registered as a Cornish in America. So, if you want some more interesting information on the family. In the course of that, he mentions a whole series of names. So, for example, he mentions about the Trithewey family and the Blaney family. Many of those families, the Trithewey family, doesn't go into it in the book, but the Trithewey's are definitely a mid-Cornwall family. They came from the St. Stephen Parish, very prominent Methodists, and in fact, members of that family have gone all around the world. They originally came from the Clay Country area. Similarly, Blaney is very localised in terms of the St. Austell area. So again, another connection between mid-Cornwall and California. But I put down four examples here of William and Philip Nichols. I don't know if any of these names are
Nichols and Arthur.
The Nichols family came from St. Austell. Members of that family actually still carried on, and the branch of the China Clay Company was called Selleck, Nichols and Williams. So that branch stayed behind. But obviously in this case, two brothers actually move out, as you see there. Settled in Forest City, established a gold mine business, 1861, open a bank at Dutch Flat, and then the family continues. You see the four generations of the Nichols family celebrated the 100th birthday of a member of the family in California who died at the grand old age of 101. A very strong connection. Members of that Nichols family, in fact, actually continue to come back to the St. Austell area before returning back to California. Trelevan. When I go back from California, our next event as part of the Scholar Festival is actually having a choir, the Perriners from Perrin Hall, and other musicians and dancers, and we can actually gather at a local pub called the King's Arms, which is in Luxillian, very close to the Eden Project. And interestingly enough, recently they've got never got a bar made in California. So if you want to come over, anytime. But anyway, Luxillian is very much on the edge of the Clay Country area. As you see there, Thomas Trelevan, 1866, initially going to Lake Superior, but then settles in Johnsville, apparently works in the Eureka mine, in 1868 brought his family over from Cornwall. It's another thing to consider. You know, for many years, members of the family would actually stay back in Cornwall. Yeah, exactly. But in this case, he was very successful. In 1878, he sold his mining enterprise in California and made quite a nice pack of money. Wastarak, I don't know if anybody has come across that, but the name Wastarak is very prominent in mid-Cornwall, you see there. It means, in translated from Cornish into English, flashy ford, according to A.O. Reves. Suddenly there's a farm of that name in the parish of St. Denis. Clay Country is made up of a series of closely knitted parishes, St. Stephen's, Roche, St. Thomas, Treverben, and to some extent Luxillian. But in the case of Henry Bond Wastarak, formerly a Wesleyan minister, becomes an ordained minister in the Episcopal Church based at San Diego, in 1902, elected the first bishop of Arnold England. Again, came originally from the area. And finally, Brokenshire. Brokenshire is the name that originally wasn't spelled Brokenshire. I think that's more of an English corruption, really. Brokenshire was originally. But essentially restricted to that mid-Cornwall area. Many members of that family still continue there today. And in this case, 1894, John Brokenshire leaves St. Stephen's, the parish of St. Stephen's in the Clay Country, goes to Hamadorn, I don't know if I'm pronouncing this right, Hamadorn, is it? Place of Counties. And later becomes an engineer in the railroad shops of the Southern Pacific at San Jose. Has seven children, one was a mining engineer, and three served in France in World War I. And that's just a few examples of people who came from McCormick. One of the things, linking back to my talk this morning, was that it would be good if we can create a comprehensive package to see where and when particular families did move to. If it is a common practice for members of the same family and members of the same community to go to places, where does this fit in with this California picture? Anyway, that's it for me. I've gone on a little bit, but I thought I'd give you the insight into Mascola and its attempts to actually continue Cornish culture, in particular mid-Cornwall culture, in the early 21st century. Thank you very much.
Have a gift for you. Make you an official Cornish cousin.
Oh, thank you.
So hopefully you'll take California back with you.
I will indeed.
And remember
us. I will wear it at the rest of the festival.
Good. One more thing, Jan, are you ready to pick?
Yeah.
Gage thought that Gary would be a good one to pick because he's impartial.
Okay.
So you can pick the ticket to see who wins the city.